This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Rowan Jacobson. Rowan is the James Beard Award-winning author of A Geography of Oysters, Fruitless Fall, American Terroir, and other books. He has written for the New York Times, Harper's, Outside, Mother Jones, and others, and his work has been anthologized in the Best American Science and Nature Writing and Best Food Writing collections. Rowan Jacobson is here today to tell us about his most recent book, Apples of Uncommon Character, 123 Heirlooms, Modern Classics, and Little-Known Wonders, published in 2014. Welcome, Rowan.
Thanks, Diane. Good to be here.
Good to have you. What led you to write a book about apples?
You know, I'd been fascinated with apples for years. I bought an old house in Vermont in the woods about 11 years ago, and it came with a bunch of old apple trees that some previous owner long ago had planted. And they bore fruit that didn't look like any fruit I'd ever seen in a store. Some of it was russeted. It had that sort of brown sandpapery skin on it, and others were crazy mixed colors. They were clearly not the kinds of trees that were producing Red Delicious or Granny Smith or the few varieties that you'd see in a store. And that got me curious about apples and what they could do that we didn't know they could do. And then a neighbor of mine started making cider, hard cider, also about 10 years ago. And I started making cider with him. His ciders were way, way better than anything you could find in a grocery store. And the fruit he was using, again, were completely different apples. They were apples that you almost couldn't eat them fresh. If you bit into it, you would just get this explosion of tannins and acids that would just totally pucker your mouth. And he explained that great ciders were made from cider fruit, fruit that was purposefully raised for that. Just like if you're making wine, you would use Cabernet Sauvignon, you wouldn't use table grapes. So that got me realizing that there was a lot more to apples going on than most people realized. And then I sort of dug into the 19th century books that have been written on apples and just started exploring the hundreds of varieties that are out there.
Where did apples come from originally? What is their origin?
They sprung to life in the Tian Shan Mountains between Kazakhstan and China probably 10 million years ago. And it's kind of amazing. Those wild apple forests still exist. So they're starting to get cut down for, you know, billionaires, dakas and stuff. But in those mountains on the borderlands, mostly on the Kazakhstan side, you can still walk through areas where more than half the trees in the forest are apples. So if you're there in the fall, there'll just be fruit all over the ground. And it looks like apples. They're a little bit smaller than our domestic apples, but they taste like apples and they look like apples.
How did apples move to other parts of the globe?
Apples kind of evolved to be appealing to bears and horses, larger animals like that, who would eat the fruit and then spread the seeds around. But then the Crusades moved some people in, and then the Silk Road went right through that region. And pretty soon, people were eating the apples as well as the horses and liked them, and then started carrying the fruit around and planting seeds. And then the apple moved both east and west and became a big deal in Europe and China.
What's the history of the apple in the U.S.?
It's not native to here, so it didn't come here until the colonists brought it over in the 1600s. But it took off. As soon as it got here, it took off and did incredibly well for itself. We did have crab apples over here already that were native, so the pollinators knew what to do with the apple trees when they got them.
How many apple varieties are there?
No one really knows. The USDA has at least 7,000 varieties on the books that have appeared in catalogs for sale in the United States. So 7,000, and you know, usually you see just a handful in a grocery store. A lot of those varieties have been lost to us now. But the thing about the apple is that it doesn't come true from seed. Like if you take a Red Delicious apple, take the seed out of it, plant that seed, the tree that grows up from that will not produce Red Delicious apples because that seed has a mix of genes, partly from its mother tree and partly from its pollen parent. And so it's a unique individual mix of genes, and so the apples it produces will never have been seen before on the planet. So it's a potential new variety. Every single seed is a potential new variety. So there could be limitless varieties.
Would you say more about how the varieties have come about?
Well, so when you plant a seed, that tree that springs up will have some new crazy apple on it, and 99 out of 100 times it won't be a very good apple. It'll be, you know, a small little sour green apple or something like that. So as the American frontier was developed and as more and more farmers planted apple seeds everywhere, thousands, probably millions of these trees sprung up. And most of them, the sour apples they produced, just went straight to the pigs or maybe to the fermentation barrel to make cider. But whenever somebody did find a sweet one or one that had some other use that was really good, they could make more of that tree basically by cloning it. Asexual reproduction. You take a cutting from the tree and graft that cutting onto another rootstock or the branch of another tree, and you can grow apples that are exactly like the original tree's apples. So that's how variety comes into existence. Farmer finds an apple that he likes, he grafts it, makes more of those trees. Then his neighbor says, hey, you know, I like that red apple you've got there. Can I have a cutting of that? Gives his neighbor a cutting. And then pretty soon all the farms in that area would have that same apple. And they'd usually name it after the farmer. So it would be called, you know, like Blaxton's Yellow Seedling or something like that, or Blaxton's Yellow Pippin. So they would each take on a name and a variety. But it was almost all regional back in the day.
To what extent has intentional breeding played a role in creating new apple varieties, for example, from university agricultural departments?
Yeah, that's the way it's done now. Throughout the 1800s, it was really just farmers being breeders. You know, they kind of took care of it all themselves, and it was hit and miss. No one was really focused on doing that. But then starting with Cornell in, I think, the late 1800s, the university agricultural services started trying to breed better apples. So they would just speed up that process by making thousands of crosses or even tens of thousands of crosses, growing out the little trees until they would bear fruit, and then just picking the best few of those and trying them out for commercial production. So that speeded up the process, but it's still always been, you know, good old-fashioned sexual reproduction.
Are there plans to do genetic engineering on apples?
There is. There's an apple that an orchard up in British Columbia has applied. They want to sell in the U.S. It is a genetically modified apple, which has been modified so that it won't turn brown when you cut it open. But so far, the USDA has not allowed it in the country. And the farmers in the U.S. are dead set against it because apples have a very wholesome reputation and they don't want this to come in and muddy the waters. But stay tuned.
How many apple varieties are generally available to the American public?
That's a good question, and depends where you look. And it's changing. Like I said, when a lot of us grew up, you had maybe two. You had Red Delicious and Golden Delicious. And then Granny Smith came along in the 1980s and was like, holy cow, a green apple. And then you started getting the striped apples maybe 10 years later, like Braeburn and Fuji, really sweet sort of tropical flavored apples. And now it's all kind of broken open. And if you go into a Walmart or a Whole Foods, you'll see 10, 12 varieties of apples. And I think Honeycrisp kind of broke the market wide open. That was the first apple that came along that people would pay more for. They just loved it. It was the first apple that people became obsessed with. They didn't care what the price was. They wanted Honeycrisps. And since then, I think the breeding programs realized that people would pay more and seek out a cool apple, and they're open to novel apples. So suddenly you got these pink ladies on the market and jazz and all these crazy flavors in them, and we're going to see a lot more of that. Every year we're going to see brand new apples that are a little bit different than anything that's come before.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Rowan Jacobson, author of the book Apples of Uncommon Character, 123 Heirlooms, Modern Classics, and Little Known Wonders. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. What has made some apples popular and not others?
Yeah, it's funny because everything we see now in a grocery store is there because it's supposed to be a really good out-of-hand apple, as they call it, or dessert apple is often the word for it. It's one you eat fresh. Everything in a grocery store is basically meant to taste good fresh. But throughout history, fresh eating was a minority of the uses of an apple. Some apples made great baking apples, made pies that are probably better than any pie we could make today. But you wouldn't want to eat one fresh because it was really hard and usually pretty tart. And those qualities tend to add a lot of interest to pies. You want an apple that's going to stay firm in a pie. So there were baking specialists, famous apples like Calville Blanc from France and Bramley Seedling from England. That was their whole purpose. So I'm wondering if in a few years, maybe we'll see a baking specialist reappear in stores. But then other apples, like I said, were purely for cider. And there were even varieties that had been seized on because they dried so well. Dried apples were a big thing in the 1700s and 1800s before there was any refrigeration. So there's an apple called a Maiden's Blush, really pretty apple. It was purely for drying. If you had a Maiden's Blush tree, you weren't going to do anything with it but slice up those apples and dry them. And there's other apples that were there because they would come ripe in July when you hadn't had a fresh apple in a long time. Some would be ripe in fall. And then other apples were way too hard when you picked them in October, November. So you'd stick them in your root cellar for 3 or 4 months. And that would be your fresh fruit in March or April. So the apples made a lot of things possible for that self-sufficient farmstead lifestyle.
Would you speak about the history of red delicious apples, which has been our most popular apple?
And technically it still is, but I was just in Yakima yesterday. I was talking with some growers who told me that they think Red Delicious has been the most popular apple, the most grown apple in America since the 50s, I'd say. But this year they think it might actually slip to number two. It's going to be neck and neck with Gala. Gala has come on strong, and they think this might be the year that Gala finally passes Red Delicious. Red Delicious has been on a downward slope for a couple of decades. It's now the apple that everybody loves to make fun of. But it had a proud past. It was found as just a volunteer escape seedling on a farm in Iowa in the 1800s. And then it won a contest for best new apple that a nursery called Stark Brothers Nursery out in Missouri was holding. And the Stark Brothers guys, they were saving the name Delicious for just the right apple. They'd waited years. And then this incredibly sweet, delicious, big red apple came along, and they thought, this is the one. So they named it Delicious. It was just Delicious at the time, not Red Delicious. And they marketed it heavily, and people went crazy for it. It grew really well. It was sweeter than other apples that had come along up to that point. It was pretty. But it's funny, if you look at that apple today, you would not think of it as a Red Delicious. It kind of had that molar shape that is so iconic of the Red Delicious. But it wasn't nearly as elongated as the ones are today. And it wasn't super red. It was kind of striped with red and a little bit of yellow stripes. That apple became super popular. Everyone in Washington State started growing it. Then Stark Brothers found another apple that they loved that was a yellow apple that they wanted to pair with it. So they named that one Golden Delicious. And then they switched the name of Delicious to Red Delicious. So then you had your Red and Golden Delicious, which were number one and number two for a very long time. But the weird thing in the industry is that growers are paid a premium based on the redness of the apple. There's no measure for flavor, but it's a color measure because the redder apple always sells better in stores. So the redder that their Red Delicious were, the bigger their premium would be. So over time, they kept selecting what are called sports, which are mutations that one particular branch will produce that might have a deeper red skin. So through the decades, we've kept slightly changing the Red Delicious genetics as we selected for these sports that had deeper and deeper red skin. The technical term for the color of a Red Delicious is midnight red, which I kind of like. It's sort of slightly surreal. But along the way, we lost some of the genes that produce flavor in the Red Delicious. So now we have this modern Red Delicious that's ridiculously deep red with skin so thick that, you know, you almost need a chisel to get through it. And not a lot of flavor inside. So what was once a great apple is now kind of a, you know, laughing stock.
Would you say more about the correlation between taste and appearance of apples?
There really isn't any. It's funny. We have this tendency to just go for bright red fruit. I think it probably goes back to our primate past. But a lot of the best apples can be very ugly. Like those russet apples that have the sandpapery skin on them. We're kind of no longer trained to think of that as a good tasting apple. It looks like something's wrong with it. But those are some of the tastiest apples imaginable. They often have kind of a pear quality to them, and their skin looks a little pear-like. So I almost think that there's a few pear genes in there. Apples and pears aren't that far off from each other. And then, yeah, you'll see apples that have pale, pale yellow flesh, and there's purple-skinned apples. And lots of ones with sort of crazy flames almost coming up the sides of them, red, yellow, and orange. really, really pretty, but really different than what we've sort of been trained to look for.
How do university breeding program apples compare to heirlooms in terms of quality?
Any apple that one of the universities actually releases onto the market has been seriously tested for any kind of problems. So it's going to be a pretty darn good apple. And it seems like all the ones that are coming out now are very high quality, but they all tend to be high quality in the same way. They're kind of in the Honeycrisp mode because everyone loves Honeycrisp. So they have that super explosively crisp texture where you bite into it and it just kind of snaps and pops. And they tend to be quite sweet. So the quality of all the new apples is really good, but they all have a similarity.
What do you consider the best apples on the planet?
That's a good question. There's a few of them. You'd have to start with Cox's Orange Pippin, which is the most famous eating apple in England. It got started in, I think it was 1825, maybe, in southern England. And it and a few relative apples that were bred from it have this incredible sort of a complex flavor that mixes what we think of as normal apple flavors with more citrus-like flavors, a lot of orange and a little pineapple in there, even maybe a little marshmallow. They're really fascinating and much more interesting flavors than we get in most of our apples. They don't grow quite as well, so they've never been quite as commercially viable. But Cox's Orange Pippin is an incredible apple. Honeycrisp is definitely a great apple, mostly for texture. Its flavor is pretty run-of-the-mill. Then there are a few other apples from the American past that I think are going to come back. There's one called Esopus Spitzenberg, which is a great name for an apple. It comes from Esopus, New York in the 1700s. And it has almost like a caramelized brandy kind of a flavor to it. Very, very good apple. It was the favorite apple of Thomas Jefferson and George Washington. And some of the founding fathers knew it well and really loved it. And somehow, I don't know why that one slipped away because it grows pretty well. But I think you're going to see that one making a big comeback. Then there's a couple that have been below the radar. My money would be on these guys to break out. One's called the Chestnut Crab. It's real small, not as small as what you think of as a true crab apple, but maybe halfway between that and a regular apple in size. Very sweet, very crisp. And then there's another called a Pixie Crunch, which is not an old apple. It was developed by one of the breeding programs in, I think, the 70s maybe. And for some reason, it just didn't get picked up, but it does everything a Honeycrisp does and better. It's a small, bright red apple. Almost looks like a candied apple or something, you know? And it's incredibly sweet and incredibly crisp. It just kind of explodes when you bite into it. And it's so sweet, you can see this kind of like amber-colored sugar syrup dripping out of it when you bite into it. And it's the perfect size for a kid to hold. The growers think that everyone wants gigantic apples in stores, but what I've found is that a lot of consumers like a slightly smaller apple that's a little bit less of a commitment. Pixie Crunch fits perfectly for that kind of market. So I could see, you know, every school lunch program should be handing a Pixie Crunch to every kid in America. And they haven't been available commercially, but I was just talking with a grower out in Yakima who has an organic orchard called Harmony Orchards, and he's got quite a few Pixie Crunches coming. So I think in a couple of years, you'll start to see them in stores.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Rowan Jacobson, author of the book Apples of Uncommon Character, 123 Heirlooms, Modern Classics, and Little Known Wonders. For the most part, who are the growers of apples?
Washington State leads the way by far in the U.S. I think this year the crop is going to be like 260 billion bushels, and 160 billion of those will be from Washington State. So, you know, like 60% of U.S. apples are grown here in Washington, with a couple other states like Michigan and New York kind of a distant second and third. But worldwide, China dominates. China grows five times as many apples as the entire U.S. So they really set all the pricing on apples in terms of international, although most of theirs goes to concentrate. The quality isn't nearly as high as it is here in Washington State. So probably over time, what we're going to see is China being like the bulk commodity supplier of apples and the U.S. and Washington in particular being the high-end gourmet fruit.
If you look at the types of farms growing the apples, is it small family farms or is it large farms?
Here in Washington, it tends to be very large farms, some of the largest orchards in the world. Just huge. It's actually pretty inspiring. I was just driving around through them yesterday, and it's just like fruit everywhere you look. Just these trees just bursting with red or yellow fruit, and just an incredible amount of it, and just like these rolling hills of it. It's really, really gorgeous. When you go back east, where I live in Vermont, you see much, much smaller farms. In New England, everything tends to be split up into small blocks, and you've got people maybe just farming a couple of acres of apples here and there.
In Washington State, how many different varieties are grown here?
There's six varieties that make up 90% of the production. So basically just a few varieties for everything. But then the last 10% is all over the place, and you're seeing a lot of different things come in. Right now, they're starting to grow a lot of cider fruit here because the cider industry is exploding and needs good fruit. So that's sort of a big open market now. So there'll be more of a mix as the years go by. But right now, the classic six varieties dominate.
What do you consider the most underappreciated apples?
That's a good question. It's got to be the russets. My one piece of advice for everybody would be to go out there and try a russet. And any of those apples that has that look to them, the brown, fuzzy skin, it's going to have a really nice, sweet, tart, nutty flavor to it. It'll be very crunchy, like not crisp like a Honeycrisp, but crunchy. It'll be a workout for your mouth. And they tend to be good a little bit later in the season. They come off the tree really high in acid, and you need to let them sit for a while and let that acid kind of go down. They'll mellow in storage. So then right around, say, November, they start to get incredibly good with this depth of flavor that you don't see in the other apples.
What efforts have been made to save and or increase apple diversity? For example, bring back heirlooms, that sort of thing.
Yeah, there's some people around the country who are doing a really good job of that because, as I mentioned, there were those 7,000 varieties back in the 1800s. And then once we switched to a more industrial scale production of fruit and those self-sufficient farms started to disappear, there were many fewer people breeding apples or keeping these old trees going. So we lost a lot of varieties by the wayside. But there were always these kind of, you know, like apple geek guys who loved apples and would basically be collectors and have these almost like museums of old apples where they would keep alive 300 varieties or 400 varieties. And those guys, they all trade with each other. They go have, you know, cyanwood exchanges where they'll swap something they don't have for something somebody else doesn't have. And through that, the old varieties have stayed alive, but just barely. Like at any one time, you might be able to only find 10 or 20 trees of some variety in the whole country. And then there's also a few fruit explorers, as they call themselves, who try to find varieties that have been lost. Because the thing about an apple tree, and that's kind of rare compared to almost all our other food plants, an apple tree can go 200 years. So even though it may be out of fashion for a century, if we suddenly have a change of heart and want it back, it might still be hanging out in some abandoned field somewhere going, hey, here I am, you know? So there are guys who kind of pour through the old nursery catalogs from the 1800s or the old books and try to pinpoint where an apple used to be dominant, used to have a lot of fans, and then they'll go and talk to old timers and just try to track down some old tree. Because if you can just find one old tree, you can take cuttings off of it, and then you can grow a whole new batch of young trees. So there's probably more than 100 varieties that we thought were extinct that have been found and brought back.
In your book, you say that the second age of the apple is at hand. Would you explain?
Yeah, well, half of it is cider, I would say, and the other half is this change in consumer mentality. I almost think we went through this weird stretch in the 50s, 60s, even into the 70s, where consumers didn't care about variety that much. And everything was kind of streamlined and industrialized, and progress was exciting. And we kind of lost the spice of life along the way. And now the slow food movement and local food movement, and I think various other trends have come together where now it's clear consumers have spoken. They want lots of variety. They want interesting things. Even if they're not as easy to work with, they're willing to have a deeper relationship with their food. And apples are perfect for that. So it is kind of they're the right thing for where we're at as a food culture.
What do you hope your book will accomplish?
To crank that up a little bit more. Basically, I put the book together because I was just blown away by how beautiful and interesting a lot of these apples were. and by the things you could do with them. And there was nothing out there that would help people kind of realize that quickly. There are a lot of horticultural books would have teeny tiny pictures of these super gorgeous apples in them and very basic flavor descriptions, but nothing for those of us who don't necessarily want to grow an orchard but want to just like discover some really cool apples. So my book is to make as many people as possible discover really cool apples.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Go out to your farmers markets and pick your own and try apples that you haven't ever seen before. I think our tendency is to go for the familiar. Go for the unfamiliar.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Rowan.
Thanks, Diane.
You were just listening to Rowan Jacobson, author of the book Apples of Uncommon Character, 123 Heirlooms, Modern Classics, and Little Known Wonders, published in 2014 by Bloomsbury Publishing. For more information, check on the web at rowanjacobson.com. Again, that's rowanjacobson.com. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts, along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on Demand, and then Podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on listener-powered 90.3 FM and kexp.org.